Hey everyone, and welcome to Risky Business, your weekly information security news and current affairs show. My name's Patrick Gray. We'll be jumping right on into a discussion of the week's security news with Adam Boileau in just a moment, and then we'll be hearing from this week's sponsor, VMRay. VMRay makes a sandbox-based malware analyzer, and its co-founder and CEO, Carsten Willems, will be along this week to talk about a competition it participated in at DEF CON. Entrants had to fiddle with malware to slide it past three different machine learning-based malware classifiers, and yeah, that was a little bit easier than it should have been. That chat with Carsten is a lot of fun, and it is coming up after the news, which starts now. And Adam, jailbreakers of the world, rejoice. The happy times are here.
Yeah, it's been a big news week in the jailbreak scene for the iOS platform. We've seen the release of some kind of exploit in the iOS boot ROM code, with the net result that we have now a fairly universal jailbreak for devices that you can trigger during the boot up process and game command execution, bypassing a bunch of Apple's controls. And of course, you know, that's shaken people up a bit, because we haven't seen, you know, one like this in a number of years and across a very wide range of devices, you know, going back a while. So yeah, pretty big week.
Yeah, and the person who found this did it by diffing, which is kind of funny, because it turns out Apple silently fixed it. Whoops.
Well, I mean, it's a great example of, you know, the just because something's been looked at by a whole bunch of people in the past doesn't mean you shouldn't go back and look for more bugs, because, yeah, people do introduce new bugs. There's old ones lurking around. Sometimes it's just, you know, you got to look in the right way in the right place. But, yeah, this one's just – it's difficult for Apple because, you know, because it's in the boot ROM, you know, it's – they kind of can't really fix it very well.
So hang on. This is something that kind of confused me, right? Like, if it is in the firmware, it's in the boot ROM, how was someone able to do the diffing in that case, right? Like, if it's unpatchable, what patch did they have to do the bin diffing with? Like, it just broke me a little.
You know what? Actually, I don't know that. I mean, I'm assuming that they looked at different revisions of the boot ROMs over time and yeah, were able to kind of diff it that way, as opposed to it being an over-the-air update or something later on. But yeah, I'm not 100% sure. You know, I'm not super into the details of Apple's hardware, so I don't really know. But there's a number of factors that are, you know, sort of been misreported, I suppose, about this particular issue. You know, it's not a universal, like, no interaction jailbreak over the air. It's not a browser bug. It's not a kernel bug. You know, it's the sort of thing that you can trigger when the phone's in, like, DFU update mode. So you have to kind of have physical access to the device. You have to be able to plug a cable into it. You have to be able to hold the power buttons down. So it's not a thing you can do easily remotely. And then at that point, you can jailbreak the boot process, inject
You can
code,
jailbreak it.
Jailbreak it. You can jailbreak during the boot process and gain control of the device. It doesn't bypass the need for a PIN, or this, you know, the secure enclave is not compromised by this. So it does mean that you can perhaps Trojan the device, or you can use it on your own legitimate device where you do know the PIN numbers, or you freshly reset it to then gain control over the rest of the OS. So it's really useful for, you know, researchers and you know, people who are bug hunting on the platform. Kind of less useful for malware authors. Plausibly useful for you know, law enforcement or people who are looking to, you know, kind of build other tools change to compromise the device. And anyone else who's doing work on the platform, it's going to be a super valuable thing to have, but it isn't, you know, really going to facilitate a whole bunch of really bad things happening as well. So it's kind of a, you know, a pretty good case for Apple, I suppose, you know, for this kind of bug.
Yeah, so I mean, it won't let anyone use this to, like, unlock the devices, but you could theoretically load it with some software that would capture the PIN, and then you could come back and get the PIN later, right?
Yeah, I mean, it'd be a very useful tool to build into a pipeline with other things. And if you've got other bugs, then absolutely it might be a very useful thing to have. And I'm sure, you know, that people like Cellbrite or the other people who are selling, you know, lawful unlock tools probably are going to be all over this, because it's just going to make their lives easier. It takes one kind of...
Well, I mean, hey, Adam, Apple did promise us some research phones, right?
Well, and now we're helping ourselves to them, it seems. Yeah, but I mean, you know, it could have been a lot worse, I think. And obviously, I'm sure everyone over at Apple are having a pretty bad week dealing with it, because, I mean, it is very, you know, they're in a very difficult position of not really being able to do anything about it, unless you've got, you know, the X, XR and later phones, I think, are the only ones where the boot ROMs were not affected. But yeah, I mean, still pretty big. We haven't seen a bug like this, you know, one that's this widespread, that allows widespread jailbreaking of iOS devices in a very long time.
Yeah, I think just on a slightly related topic, iOS is now up to version 13.1.2 or something like that.
Yeah, they've been cranking this week on the updates.
And I saw a funny tweet. I can't remember who it was. Sorry about that. But it said, what is it? Daily releases of iOS 13 will continue until morale improves, which I thought was pretty good,
Was it Apple whose bug bounty program was kind of incentivizing you to drop bugs in the pre-release versions? Like when they?
I think they were doing that.
Yeah, because that was what they announced at Black Hat this year. And I guess like this kind of thing is exactly why, right? So that you don't have everybody sitting on their bugs waiting for release day for actual production release and then rubbing your nose and all the things they found during the pre-release phase. So.
Well, the old rule with iOS updates used to be wait for the first point release. And now I think it's wait for maybe the second or third point release. So
like maybe wait out the first day so they can get past the first 3 point releases.
Yeah, exactly. Now, look, this is another little Apple issue. Look, it's something that wouldn't normally make the news, but I just found it kind of funny. And seeing as we're talking about Apple, there was a Chrome update that wound up breaking Macs. But the way that it broke Macs is actually really funny because, you know, macOS has this really weird, system integrity protection stuff that essentially locks parts of the file system, right? So system files, system directories, things like that. So it turned out this Chrome update was trying to fiddle with sensitive parts of the system. But if you had SIP on, which is on by default, it wouldn't allow those changes to occur, so no problem, right? But then Chrome shipped this patch, and people who had disabled for a system integrity protection, which, you know, for some software and stuff, you might have to do that, maybe temporarily, maybe permanently, but for people who disabled it, Chrome was actually able to make those changes and completely balked their boxes to the point where they couldn't reboot. I just think this is a really funny thing where, like, you can totally tell that, like, the reason it passed their regression testing is because no one thought, hey, let's try this on a box that's SIP disabled.
Yeah, funny, exactly. Right? Like who tests their, tests their code on a box that's got all the security turned off or has one of the security controls turned off. Like maybe Google's learned a lesson. They can have that in their test cases now. But it was pretty funny because it like an RM, some symlink to VAR. You could see why that might break things a little bit.
But I mean, how did that get in there in the first place?
Crazy. It's a crazy Unix anyway. It's not even a real Unix. It's a mad Unix.
Now, look, speaking of crazy.
God.
I don't like bringing this up, right? I don't like bringing Trump into Risky Business because then I have to deal with about 2 weeks of politics in a security podcast, right? But we kind of have no choice here, right? Because unless you've been hiding under a rock, you would know that things in US politics are pretty heated at the moment. And the whole controversy, which could possibly lead to the impeachment, of Donald Trump. Hinges on this phone call with the president of Ukraine. And what's really bizarre is he mentions CrowdStrike, right, in this call and something about a rich Ukrainian and CrowdStrike and the server. So what it seems like is Donald Trump believes that the DNC server,
the single one,
is in Ukraine because CrowdStrike apparently has a Ukraine connection and is owned by a rich Ukrainian, that's not true. I mean, it's just not true. It's really weird. Now, none of this makes any sense until you realize that for a while, I think Rudy Giuliani was actually the US cyber czar. Maybe Rudy's telling him this stuff. But God, I mean, look, on the day that all this broke, right, like CrowdStrike obviously was just, everywhere in the news. I actually sent, it was 7 in the morning. I was still waking up. I sent a couple of sort of jokey messages to Dimitri just going, ha ha, congrats on being a rich Ukrainian, which I kind of feel bad about now because it's very real for him because he's got to deal with all these crazies, right? Who think that he's part of some giant global conspiracy to bury Hillary Clinton's emails in Ukraine. I don't know, man.
The candlestick.
This is all just a bit much, isn't it?
It is.
But what I do like about this, right, is I remember where I was in 2016 when the CrowdStrike report into the DNC hack dropped. I was in São Paulo. I was traveling around Brazil. And that's when it happened. I was like, right away, I knew how serious this was going to be, right? I knew. And it feels like, if this is something that actually manages to tank that presidency, what perfect bookends, CrowdStrike there at the beginning and the end. But what did you think watching all this unfold?
Just because it's just stupid. Like the whole thing is stupid. It just demonstrates such a kind of, a misunderstanding of the process by which, investigating what happened to DNC, like the server and the involvement of CrowdStrike, this complete misunderstanding of the process. And then the complete just like, maybe he actually things like that. That's the thing that I suppose confuses me.
Oh, totally. You read these call transcripts and you're like, wow, it's possible he is not playing five-dimensional chess.
He really is just actually very stupid. I mean, it's just so frustrating because we, you know, the attribution for the attacks from the DNC is about as solid as it gets, right? I mean, we, the FBI practically watched them do it, or the US National Security Apparatus practically watched them do it. And
well, look, I'm going to cut you off there. On that note, former Homeland Security Advisor Tom Bossert was on ABC TV in the United States, and he had this to say.
For clarity here, George, let me just again repeat that it has no validity. The United States government reached its conclusion on attributing to Russia the DNC hack in 2016 before it even communicated it to the FBI and long before the FBI ever knocked on the door at the DNC. So a server inside the DNC was not relevant to our determination to the attribution. It was made up front and beforehand. And so while servers can be important in some of the investigations that followed, it has nothing to do with the U.S. government's attribution of Russia for the DNC hack.
Now, that seems pretty clear.
Yeah, I mean, it's about as unequivocal as you can get, right? I mean, what do you even say to that?
Yeah. So, look, you know, the TLDR is Donald Trump is very concerned about the DNC server that CrowdStrike. I can't even repeat. It's just so dumb that, like, you try to actually recite it. And you know, the other thing is here, he's, like, talking about how he still doesn't believe, Trump talks about how he still doesn't believe that Russia hacked the 2016 election. And now we find out that he apparently told Russian officials in 2017 that he didn't mind that they were interfering in the election. So, like, he seems capable of both not believing something and believing it, depending on which time of day you get to him. But, you know, it's just amazing that this whole controversy really did kick off with the DNC hack, with Russian involvement in that. And now, you know, now that it's hitting some sort of fever pitch, we're sort of right back there with cyber stuff.
Yeah, and I mean, all of the, you know, I know when this first went down, you know, we were saying, well, you know, the Russians are really good at this confusion doctrine and they really understand how to play everybody. I don't think even the Russians could foresee quite how just bat this has all gotten. You know, even they're not playing five-dimensional enough chess to foresee this.
So stupidity. apologies, Dimitri, for sending you those somewhat sort of sarcastic, jokey messages, because after that, I actually hit up Twitter for, you know, CrowdStrike-related keyword searches, and oh boy, there are some really super weird people out there who are really into this theory, right? So anyway, moving on, thank God. we've got an interesting story here where there's been some hacking going on in the aerospace sector, Adam.
Yeah, there's been a bunch of reports of, you know, a series of intrusions into airplane manufacturer Airbus and a bunch of their subsidiaries and suppliers. You know, the finger is being pointed towards the Chinese APT as usual. You know, obviously there's a bunch of reasons why China might be interested in, you know, industrial espionage, both for, you know, civilian and military aircraft production that Airbus does. But yeah, we have seen, you know, a whole number of campaigns, you know, targeting around the aerospace industry, and, I mean, you know, certainly something the size of Airbus. I mean, I can't even imagine how difficult it would be to defend a network like that. But yeah, according to reports, they are making efforts to shore up, you know, their defenses against such intrusions. Whether or not that will actually help, I don't know. But the attribution to China.
Well, I mean, they're not going to steal Boeing's code, are they?
Oh, dear.
So, look, it's not really super clear what's happened here, what the entry point was. There will be some more information on this one coming out through the week, I am led to believe, right? But, the full story is not entirely out there yet, so we'll just endeavour to update you on that one when we return from break in a few weeks. Staying with the aviation theme, and, you know, the US actually did buy a 757 to let people hack on. But then there was a bit of a barney between researchers who participated in that program and Boeing, and the whole thing kind of went cold. Looks like they're dusting it off. and getting serious about it again, which is just fantastic.
Yeah, I mean, clearly aerospace systems, you know, especially the flight systems, are, you know, a thing that are just as much computers as everything else. And getting your hands on test equipment and test environments is really difficult. And the, you know, the industry as a whole has been pretty hostile historically to hackers and researchers. I mean, you know, we've seen the response to Ruben Santamata's research over the years. You know, it's always pretty hostile, especially from Boeing, more than anyone else, I think. And anything that improves that. And the US Air Force, of course, by showing up at DEF CON and running, you know, some of the things at a Hacking Village there, you know, clearly they are recognizing the importance of engaging with the research community. And I think that, you know, it's going to be good for everybody in the industry to kind of open up, much like we've seen in the auto, you know, automotive industry. You know, that increased openness just benefits everybody and, you know, gives us hackers some better toys to play with.
Yeah, so there you go. You might be able to get your hands on a 757. Happy days. Oh, God, look, we've got a whole section in this week's news segment about ransomware stuff. We've got hospitals in Alabama and also here in Australia that have been affected by ransomware. We're talking about delayed surgeries and, yeah, so the ones here in Australia, like I'm hearing that it's perhaps a little bit worse than is being reported to the public at the moment. And, you know, I've got some unverified tip info here that says it was a, you know, Ryuk Imatet trick bot. And, you know, PowerShell shenanigans type of deal. But, I mean, you know, we've got this situation where we've got, yeah, hospitals unable to perform surgeries. That's in two countries. I've got another news story here from the HIPAA Journal about some general practice in Simi Valley in California, the Wood Ranch Medical. They are actually closing after a ransomware attack. We have got a defense contractor, Rheinmetall, where its plants in Brazil, Mexico, and the United States have been disrupted by a malware infection, which I'm guessing is also going to be ransomware. We got a news story here on ZDNet saying that over 500 US schools were hit by ransomware in 2019. And this Danish company, a manufacturer of hearing aids, they are mopping up an incident which is expected to cost $95 million to remediate. So, yeah, I mean, this is where we are, right? Like, it is... I get the feeling that this is rising to near emergency levels.
Yeah, we certainly, if you looked at the number of stories about ransomware that we've talked about in, on the show in the last few years, there's absolutely an increase in them. And it's, you know, it's interesting because, you know, it demonstrates a way to monetize attacks. If that's one of the things that makes it, you know, more useful, because clearly, you know, monetizing stealing data is more difficult and monetizing selling access is more difficult. Just ransomware things like maybe works enough that you can make some cash. So it's kind of a thing that makes a lot of sense for people to do. But one of the things that concerns me about this, of course, is because it's so visible, we do see this kind of false equivalency arising between ransomware and hacking, right? Obviously, there's a bunch of other things you can do with hacking, but in the public perception, like much like movie hacking in the 90s, you know, people expect to see spinning skulls. Now people expect to see ransomware, like that's the only thing we can do. And of course, we know that, you know, a very small percentage of intrusions then result in ransomwareing because clearly a bunch of other people are doing a bunch of other things.
Sure, but only a small amount of incidents result in patients being turned away from hospitals and children being turned away from schools. I think that's probably... You know, I get what you're saying, which is we've got to be careful not to overemphasize this as you know, we solve this, we've solved everything. But this is causing real world impacts that are quite serious.
Well, and that's where I was going to go. I mean, normally I would say that, you know, because we're focusing so much on this, because it has such an impact, then we, you know, we're kind of losing sight of all of the other things that hackers do that matter. On the other hand, there's nothing like a good owning to really get people motivated to do things better. And ransomware is great in that regard because it is really forcing people to go, hey, this is a thing that can have a, you know, an understandable impact. Whereas, you know, having your data stolen or having, you know, your company broken into and hackers do mysterious things, who knows what, for years, like the impact of that is much less obvious. And so ransomware is kind of useful in a way. And I imagine the health sector is going to get a real shakeup, as with local government, as with schools everywhere we're seeing getting targeted. You know, the way that they procure and fund IT and the way they do IT maintenance and backups and disaster planning, all of that's going to get shaken up for the better as a result.
Well, I don't know that that's true. I mean, I know people who work in healthcare and I know how poorly resourced they are because every single dollar they take to throw at IT is a dollar that they can't contribute towards patient care, right? So they don't want to spend this money. And I don't think we should put them in a situation where they should have to, you know? The world is stretched thin when it comes to essential services, schools, hospitals, things like that, right? We're already stretched thin. And the last thing we bloody need is for those organizations to have to go and quadruple their bloody security spending. That's why I keep coming back to this, you know, to advocating for serious action against the people who are actually doing this stuff. I think, you know, the intelligence community needs to get involved. And I think we need to start outing these people, you know, doxing them, maybe including, you know, some details on how much Bitcoin they have. And then we let the law of the jungle handle the rest, Adam.
Ah, yes, the old vigilante justice. Yeah,
well, kind of. I mean, that's up to the world,
that's,
right?
That's kind of where you're heading. But, I mean, I don't know.
Cause not vigilante justice. I was just thinking, you know, maybe feeding them to other worse criminals who are going to van them and then, you know, pull their fingernails out until they cough up their passphrases.
Yeah, but it's, I don't know. It's just, it's a miserable, I mean, it's a miserable place to be. Obviously, you know, you're very right about the struggles of running healthcare systems. But also, I mean, a lot of the systems that are like this, you know, are here because the vendors aren't very good, because the vendors gouge them for, you know, way too much money. And they don't need four times the security budget. They need vendors that don't suck, right? That build systems.
Yeah, but we can't have that.
Well, exactly.
We can't have that.
Yeah, I mean, clearly we want things that we can't have. But we're going to have to come up with something that works. I mean, InfoSec, you know, security, IT in general.
Drone strikes.
Has to come up with something that actually
drone works. Strikes. Drone strikes, Adam. that's what's going to fix this. But you see where I'm coming
foreheads
from, right?
Warheads on foreheads, yes.
Warheads on foreheads, my friend. Warheads on foreheads. Anyway, now look, speaking of medical security, you remember some time ago, like quite recently, we spoke about those absolutely diabolical bugs in VxWorks, right? They had a name for them. I will use the name in this case because they were really bad, but they called them the Urgent 11, those bugs. This is a great story from Wired where Armis Security, who do IoT-based, you know, network monitoring and stuff in, and they obviously like, you know, medical is where you find those sorts of companies, right? Because they've got a lot of IoT things on their networks. They noticed like some devices were setting off alerts for VxWorks issues, but the devices didn't run VxWorks. Lo and behold, it turns out that the bugs that affected VxWorks affect a whole bunch of other real-time operating systems as well.
Yeah, this has led to some kind of software archaeology, digging up, you know, the lineage of some of these code bases. And it turns out, yeah, there is a company that wrote a fairly common IP stack way back in the 2000s that was licensed by a whole bunch of vendors that ended up in real-time operating systems. VxWorks appears to have begat this code base as well. But of course, yeah, there's a bunch of devices that use, you know, this IPnet stack from a company called Interpeak, which eventually got bought, I think, by Wind River, the people who own VxWorks, and then kind of, you know, absorbed into them. And as a result, there was no kind of maintenance or updates for that stack for the other people who had licensed it prior to its acquisition. And so, yeah, it's been running for, you know, 20, 30 years or whatever in embedded devices without anyone really knowing what the lineage of the software was and the fact that it was vulnerable to very similar bugs. And yeah, there's a bunch of people now discovering that, including, you know, medical, you know, insulin pumps and all sorts of things that you just, you know, A, you don't want on the network in the first place, and B, you don't want on the network with, you know, remote packet reassembly bugs in the kernel.
Well, they do kind of need to be on the network for various reasons, right? So, this is, man, I read this one and I just thought you're going to love talking about this one this week. Because this is like ONAP, right? The cloud computing management platform. Oh boy, did they fuck this up?
they really, really did. So this is a story about ONAP's management system for, you know, cloud computing infrastructure as a service computing. It turns out that one of the features that their control panel exposed to end users that allowed you to manage kind of some aspect of the networking in the virtual machines that were being sold involved it having to reconfigure, you know, aspects of the network stack on the virtual machines itself. And of course, it did so by just straight up SSHing into them with a key that they had already dropped in, you know, root's authorized keys file. Okay, fine, bad idea, but fair enough.
Well, it's okay, assuming you're going to keep that very important key, the private key, in a HSM, and you're going to be all careful with it, right? You would think, unless you, I don't know, maybe made a terrible configuration error.
So yeah, some researchers figured out whilst tinkering with their virtual machine that the SSH instance that's kind of logging into your virtual machine that you control has SSH agent forwarding turned on. Which, if you're not familiar with that, what that means is that the keys used to authenticate that the client that's connecting to you is authenticating with are then passed onwards through the machine you've connected to, so that then you can connect, you know, a second hop out. The server that you're connecting to has access to all of your keys and can then use them to SSH onwards to other things should it so desire. It turned out that the researcher in the question did desire that, used that to log back into the management server that it was coming from. And of course, from there, you could go onwards to every other customer's Linux box on every cloud platform managed by this vendor, which turned out to be quite a lot.
Quite a lot. Quite a lot. Yeah. So that was a thing that happened, right? Now, look, sure, it's just a configuration error, right? They can fix that. They can move on. It's not a broader comment about their products or whatever. But the reason I find this one interesting, right, is it just shows you what we're up against, which is one small configuration error where someone turned something on, forgot to turn it off, because this smacks of that, right? You would have to agree that that's what this one smells like. Someone enabled it and then, you know, forgot to disable it. This has introduced a vulnerability into all systems being managed by ONAP, which is a lot of systems, right? And thank God it was some researchers who discovered this and not some bad people. But, you know, the bad people often find stuff like this, right? This is what we're up against.
Yeah, I mean, SSH agent forwarding of this nature, this is a thing that we have used, you know, in the wild against a bunch of things, because people turn it on all over the place. It's really common anywhere that you have more complicated authentication structures for things like, you know, continuous integration or automatic deployment or anything where, you know, you have to programmatically SSH into things and it needs to be more than one deep. People use this everywhere. And yeah, I mean, it's a thing we've used. Bad guys absolutely know how to use SSH agent forwarding. And I think it's, I can't imagine that they are the first people to stumble across this. It's just way too obvious. And I'm, you know, I suspect it's been used already. Like it's too well known and too straightforward and too discoverable not to have been spotted and used before. And I mean, sadly, you know, this is when we centralize a whole bunch of stuff in the cloud infrastructure and you rely on the operators of that, of those cloud services to be really, really good, because, you know, one mistake can compromise, you know, hundreds of thousands of systems. You know, maybe that trust is not always well deserved. And that's unfortunately the case here.
But you use the cloud because the cloud operators are better at security.
So long as you never see how the sausage is made.
That's right. So this next story, we're going to be talking about law stuff. And I know there are a bunch of lawyers who listen to this program. So forgive us while we behave like a couple of drunk toddlers. To your ears, we will be sounding like a couple of drunk toddlers trying to talk about particle physics. But yeah, there's this new labor law in California. I think it really takes aim at Uber, right? So, you know, Uber drivers should be considered employees and get the same sort of treatment and benefit as employees. The cynic in me suspects that one of the reasons California is pursuing this is so it gets to collect the payroll tax. But anyway, that's a whole other story. We got a piece here on CyberScoop, which says there could be some knock-on effects to the bug bounty platforms. You know, because this is a gig economy sort of role, being a bug bounty hunter, and the thinking might be, well, hey, you know, you're going to have to treat these people like employees. I saw Katie Masouris tweeting about this a couple of weeks back, and I'm not sure. I mean, obviously, I'm not a lawyer, but I can't really see this resulting in a huge challenge to the bounty provider. Like, there's just something. My gut instinct tells me this isn't going to sink them.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of these things where, you know, I can see the point. I can see what they're trying to do with this, you know, with, you know, the likes of Uber and Lyft and a bunch of the other gig economy sorts of approaches to doing business. But bug bounty hunting doesn't seem like a great fit for what my understanding of the law is trying to achieve. And whether or not anyone's going to actually try and nail, you know, the bug crowds and HackerOne's and Cynic down, you know, who actually wants to be an employee of bug crowd? I mean, like, which of the bug hunters that we know actually want that? I don't know.
Well, I don't know. That's the thing, right? And there's this so-called ABC test, right? So you can be an independent contractor if A, workers are free from the control and direction of the hiring entity. I mean, there would be an argument about that in bug bounty cases, right? Because quite often someone's going to find a bug, then look up to see if they have a program, right? So is the program directing that? Probably not. B, the worker's responsibilities are outside the critical functions of the business. How do you define the critical functions of a business like HackerOne or BugCrowd? Is it actually doing the bug hunting, or is it receiving the reports and evaluating them, right? I would argue that it's the latter. Yeah, exactly, right? That's the service that they provide. And C, workers also have another role at an unrelated business operating in a similar field as the hiring entity. So that gets every single person who works in security and also contributes to bug bounties off the hook. But I just can't see anyone actually, yeah, like you said, wanting to be an, oh, please make me a HackerOne employee. Like, why?
Yeah, no, it's a good question. And yeah, we don't understand the specifics of the law, and I don't really understand what it means, like what extent California law applies to me selling bugs.
I reckon we could see a lawsuit though. Someone gets banned for 6 months for like scope creep or something, for, you know, going outside of scope, and then they whinge and say that they're an employee and, you know, please give me my leave or something, or where's my dental?
Maybe it's worth a try, I don't know. And there's lots of enterprising bug bounty kids and they do like hacking things, and why not hack labor laws instead of, you know, web apps?
Yeah, so let's see what happens. Some time ago we spoke about these lightning cables that have like a built-in wireless access point. Like, someone made one that looks exactly like a normal lightning cable for an iPhone, and the thinking is, you know, if you can get someone to use it, then you've got an interface to their USB port. Looks like they're going to go into production and be sold by a Hack5, so another tool for the tool bag.
Yeah, I can imagine a bunch of, you know, of pen testers who do the sort of physical and social intrusion stuff will be pretty keen on those. And, you know, Hack5 sells lots of pen testing gadgets, so it makes sense for them to be involved in manufacturing these. One does wonder how much they're going to look like Apple cables. You know, I'm sure Apple's lawyers will be, you know, kind of sucking their teeth at this point. But yeah, I mean, it seems like a useful thing to have, and, you know, better than manufacturing them by hand.
Well, I mean, the journalist who wrote this story, I think it was Joe Cox, actually got an Apple spokesperson to direct him to their online text saying, you know, make sure that you verify that you're using a real cable by looking at the MFI badge on the item's packaging, right? So there you go. Only use Apple certified cables, which doesn't really work so well when someone has broken into your office overnight and replaced your genuine. Yeah. But anyway, nice PR response there from Apple, right? You know, as usual. More SIM card issues. These are getting bad, right? Like, and the fact is, SIM cards just aren't really that hip and modern anymore, man. You know, they got issues.
Like 90s Java cards, not hip.
Yeah,
the network is the computer, Pat.
Last time we spoke about this, a bit of an interesting discussion kicked off on the Twitters with, you know, a few people, and I was sort of looped into that. And, you know, it seems like the virtual SIMs, the eSIMs that are in modern phones, they're a fully virtualized recreation of SIMs, but you'd think at least they might be able to start patching them, whereas trying to patch the actual SIM, you know, that's not going to work. We got to start moving away from these things, right?
Well, I mean, the SIM cards, they made a lot of sense, right? Having some hardware trust anchor for your key material, like in a smart card, it's totally the right approach.
I'd rather use the secure enclave processor.
These days, we've gotten a little bit better at it. I mean, that's what the SIM card was meant to be. But yeah, it's when you have a Java runtime on it and carriers can upload garbage apps that, you know, process network messages onto the SIM cards and have them run, it's a terrible idea. We have seen some updates, I guess, since we last talked about it, where it turns out there was another application that was commonly deployed on SIM cards that had similar sorts of vulnerabilities to the ones we talked about last time. But the overall understanding seems to be that these are not super widespread in their deployment. So I don't know how many people are getting actually jacked by them versus all of the other things that happen in the mobile network core, you know, for tracking you or figuring out what's going on. But certainly, yeah, if you've got a variety of old SIMs kicking around, it might be interesting to go and list what applications are on them. I know I had a rummage through my carrier's SIM menu the other day, and, you know, it was interesting.
Interesting how?
Yeah, interesting. Like, this is just a bunch of old abandoned stuff that they forgot about many years ago that's still kicking around on the SIM, but not the ones that were, you know, in question here. But there's some interesting things there.
Well, if anyone wants Adam's cell phone number, I will sell it to you for 10 Bitcoin. So there we go. Latest revenue model for
thanks,
media.
Thanks, buddy. Thanks.
What a champ. My pleasure. The cyber bunker. 7 people have been arrested for running a cyber bunker.
Yeah, the German cops have rolled on one of these kind of, you know, bulletproof hosting providers that ran their operation out of, you know, Cold War era bunkers. This is the crowd that previously ran the cyber bunker in the Netherlands.
It's my favorite thing. It's their second cyber bunker.
Well, the funny thing is, so they had a cyber bunker where they ran their hosting, but it turned out someone was like making ecstasy in the basement and it caught fire and the cops raided it and they moved out of the bunker at the time. It's like way back.
Of course. Happens all the time.
Happens all the time.
I mean, when have you not had a drug lab fire under your cyber bunker?
Like, they're natural bedfellows, obviously. But the funny thing was, like, they got kicked out of the bunker because of the drug lab. And then they were claiming that they were running it out of a bunker for like 10 years when they weren't. They didn't actually have a bunker. But anyway, they made enough money to get another bunker in Germany. Subsequently, they were hosting all sorts of, you know, shady shady things in this cyber bunker. Amazingly enough, having a bunker doesn't actually stop the cops raiding you. And they've been raided and a bunch of the stuff seized. I think they were hosting one of the underground, you know, like...
and child exploitation material, drug markets, the whole shebang, like everything that you would expect in an underground lair. But you're telling me they were running a fake cyber bunker. Are you telling me that it was a bunk bunker?
Yes, that's what you must be very happy with that one.
I am. So Cloudflare, Chrome, and Firefox have added HTTP3 support, and I saw this article and I thought, there's a HTTP3? Like, I had no idea.
This is the standardization process for Google's QUIC protocol, which is runs over top of UDP and provides an alternative transport for HTTP that's meant to provide a bunch of performance enhancements. And Google has support for QUIC in Chrome. The story now is that I think Cloudflare are going to turn it on as an option. So the sort of the 40% of the internet that hosts their Nazi content behind Cloudflare will also be able to turn that on, so we can browse that more efficiently and with less packets required. So that's the thing. But yeah, I mean, it's not, we haven't seen a huge adoption of the non-TCP transport.
This is HTTP3 is HTTP over UDP. Is that what you're telling me?
That's what I'm telling you, yes.
Man, is this a good idea?
Well, I mean, you know, the saying goes that if you don't understand TCP, you're doomed to reinvent it poorly over UDP. But, I mean, Google does kind of know how to internet a little bit, and maybe it's not the case. I mean, there's a bunch of reasons why, you know, the stream model of TCP has aged poorly, and they've tried to learn a bunch of those lessons. And, QUIC does provide a number of advantages and the same sort of reliable transport, but over the top of UDP with, you know, a bunch of things that make it better suited to the modern internet. But, you know, right now, if you go look at the network, you're still going to see a whole bunch of 443 TCP, and it's going to be that way for a long time. You know, we've been, how long's IPv6 been around? Like 25 years now, something like that. And we still don't really see it on, you know, only tens of percent of the internet.
I did a bit of reading on that HTTP request smuggling last week, and then I hear you're just telling me now that we're moving to HTTP over UDP, and I'm just starting to twitch.
I'm sure it'll be fine.
There's got to be dragons there.
I'm sure nothing will go wrong.
Well, that's one for us to talk about in 12 months, I guess. Mm-hmm. Let's see. Oh, yeah, Microsoft has banned 38 file extensions for Outlook in the web, which is, look, it makes a lot of sense. I sort of wonder why they haven't done this previously, because, like, they're really shady. You know, things like PowerShell extensions. Like, do you really need people, your office fleet being emailed PowerShell extensions?
I see what you're saying. I mean, certainly emailing JAR files around, like Java files, like, bad idea. Mailing Python files around? I mean, come on. There's plenty of people who write a lot of Python, email Python files around. That's just
But they're also the sort of people who will be able to figure out a way around this,
Zip it up. Okay, yes, fair enough. I guess they can just zip it. But I mean, everyone who works sort of behind a corporate mail filter already knows to zip all of the, the JAR files up before you get them, before you send them anyway. Everyone already does that to avoid the DLP.
I don't know. I mean, are they inspecting archives? Like, are they inspecting zips and stuff?
Well, this is why you password protect them. And then you tell the end user to type the password in.
I don't know. A lot of gateways will just drop that. Though.
Yeah, I don't know. Lots of people's DLP let a lot of people's encrypted zips out, I'll tell you that.
Yeah, that's
true. It's been a week and a half since I last had a customer send me an encrypted zip to avoid his DLP.
This one would be... Okay, no, it is. It is. It's funny.
I'm laughing.
So AT&T, one of their sites, what was it? It was erate.att.com, the admin of that site started doing a 302 redirect for like pen test traffic to the FBI tip website. So like if you throw SQL map at that AT&T website, it winds up like you're trying to SQL map the FBI tip line. I think that's kind of funny personally, but a lot of people were kind of pointing out that considering AT&T have a bug bounty and people might throw SQL map against it legitimately, maybe redirecting that to the FBI could lead to a misunderstanding that it gets someone in trouble.
I mean, it's a pretty classic boff age move, which is why we're laughing, to send the poor pen testers or bug hunters off to the FBI. But I mean, come on, like really, like you bug bounty kids, you really want it that easy? You don't have to go check who you're hitting with your tools? I mean, come on, like you wouldn't go do hacking then. You've got to at least check where you're pointing your SQL map at. Maybe do some recon before you point the SQL map at. I mean, come on.
Yeah, well, AT&T have removed the redirect, so there you go. But pretty funny. Just quickly, Microsoft has released Azure Sentinel, which is their cloud-based SIEM. This is cool, right? Because all of this Seam stuff is going going cloud, right? You've got backstory from Chronicle, which God knows what's happening with that right now, since they got sort of reabsorbed by the Google behemoth. But Microsoft is going out and trying to gobble up some market share with that, so that's interesting.
Yeah, I think this is a good move. I mean, Microsoft have done a lot of work in their security analysis tools. The cloud's a natural fit for this kind of Seam platform. A lot of the traditional Seam vendors are pretty garbage. So it's like, you know, I think the market is pretty ripe for being really shook up by, you know, some good players like Microsoft and Chronicle. So, yeah, I mean, I wouldn't want to be a legacy Seam operator at the moment.
No, I would not. And, you know, they're actually, you know, they're more and more useful, right? Like, you could just see the potential for these things. So that's great. That's under general availability now. So go get it. Go have a look at it, or go have a look at Chronicle. Microsoft, and God, man, this is great, right? Because like a few times we've spoken about how Windows would sort of offload the responsibility for BitLocker encryption to SSD drives, right? They're like, you know, we support BitLocker, just hook in that way. We'll handle all of the encryption. And it turns out most drive manufacturers, not so surprisingly, do an absolutely terrible job of implementing the crypto magic. So Microsoft is now just not allowing the drives to do that encryption. Windows is just going to handle it itself. So that's great.
That is a sensible outcome. And we never trusted the drive manufacturers to do this stuff. I mean, every encrypted disk you ever saw was always complete garbage. So it makes sense to do this on the CPU where it belongs, and just, you know, it's not worth the performance improvement. Everyone's got enough spare CPU these days. So yeah, this is a smart move for Microsoft.
Now, last week, we predicted that perhaps these vBulletin bugs.
Such
terrible,
a risky
terrible.
Prediction.
Yes, exactly. The people are going to start using them in the wild. And sure enough, they're being used. They're being used left, right, and center. But the funny part is one of the websites, one of the forums that got owned is Komodo's. So Komodo's vBulletin forum got owned. And I did with N-Day, right? Like, this is the best. This is the best story.
Yeah, I mean, security vendors, especially ones that sell certs, getting themselves owned is always a fun time. But of course, they were like, oh, well, you know, we patched it now. It's all totally fine. Nothing bad happened. And then you contrast that with Tuki Beckraff from Zerodium pointing out on Twitter that, these bugs have been being sold on the underground for like 3 years now. I'm sure anyone who wanted to own things with vBulletin bugs probably already did a long time ago because, this bug. It's pretty silly.
Now, we had a couple of reports kicking around this week that have sort of found their way onto security Twitter. Two reports, actually. One from a shoe store in Auckland, where apparently someone set up the, you know, shopfront display to play pornography. And then we saw another one going around on Vice Motherboard talking about a roadside billboard in Auburn Hills, Michigan, started to play porn as well on the big, electronic billboard. Although it looks like certainly in the case of the billboard, what actually happened is someone just got physical access to the shed with the computer in it and did it that way. No news on the New Zealand one yet, but this ain't hacking, really.
No. It's not really hacking. Like, this is just kind of teenage pranking, and certainly the security camera shots of the people breaking into the building for the one in Michigan. Yeah, like they're going to get snapped pretty quick. You know, maybe check for the cameras first before you do that, kids. But yeah, not exactly computer hacking going on here.
I think, you know, there's just so much more fun stuff you could do than put porn. Like it just seems like a wasted opportunity. Like, just to do something kind of juvenile and dumb. Like. There'd be so much more.
You know, kids are juvenile and dumb, so, you know.
I'd like to think I
would have pulled a more.
Nyan Cat would be so much more fun, right? Like, just have that on a loop.
I mean, I do feel like I probably would have done a higher class of prank when I was
Screen the Godfather. Screen the Godfather. Why not?
You know? There's definitely better options. A little content piracy. Why not?
Now, this Yahoo guy, an engineer with Yahoo, working on the mail team, Reyes Daniel Ruiz. Apparently broke into something like 6,000 mail accounts, mostly belonging to women, young women, and he was looking for nude photos. And he has pleaded guilty now to charges stemming from that. What's interesting about this, though, is until recently, he actually wound up working for Okta. And it looks like what happened is they found out about the charges and he got shit-canned pretty promptly, and then they did a bit of an audit to make sure that he hadn't accessed anything inappropriately. But yeah, I mean, you would just think, like, a guy like this, you can't put them in a position where they're responsible for any sort of sensitive access ever again, you would think.
Yeah, I mean, this is just, it's a really terrible story. I mean, not only was he using his access at Yahoo to rummage through people's mail accounts and look for, you know, attachments and files and things, he was also using that access to then password reset and gain access to, you know, iCloud and Facebook and Dropbox and things to go and look for other content. So, I mean, it's clearly showing that he's willing to abuse the access he's got beyond just kind of the first order things. And for a company like Okta, you know, where, you know, identity and access management is 100% of their core business, like, that's a thing that's just completely intolerable for them. And, you know, it's good that they stomped on it quickly. It's bad that he ended up working there in the first place. But
yeah. I mean, it happens, right? There was someone of who course, yeah. Working for one of the banks here who actually got the heave-ho after he got busted, like, taking upskirt photos. And, you know, they were just fired, insta-fired based on that one. You know, you can't have someone like that working in your office. But, you know, it's hard, right? Like, how do you vet against stuff when, like, they haven't been caught for doing anything yet? And in this case, there was no conviction yet because he hadn't been to court. So,
yeah, he's facing 5 years in jail and a fine of up to $250,000 plus restitution, which seems kind of on the low side to me.
Yeah. I mean, it strikes me as a pretty serious violation as well. I mean, you see people getting just crazy sentences for financial crime, but this is a sex crime, right? Let's be honest. And
exactly.
It should be. Well, look, I hope the guy goes down. Don't mind saying it. Now speaking of arrests, a Sydney contractor. There was a breach at a company called Landmark White, which is a property valuation firm. They're listed. It caused them a whole bunch of trouble. It seemed pretty clear from the outset that it was an insider. They took something like 170,000 records, threw them on the dark web, you know, just, it was a real slash and burn angry hack. And police in Sydney arrested a guy this morning. His name is Stephen Grant, and he was apparently a contractor who worked there. So he looks like he's in a bit of trouble.
Yeah, no, that guy's not going to have a particularly good time. And, you know, when there's a picture of you on the, you know, on the Sydney Morning Herald in handcuffs, that's...
With a blurry face. What's funny, though, is he looks a bit like a guy we know, right?
It does. We were talking before we recorded. Is that...
Yeah, no, and it maybe, wasn't, right? Because I asked around and apparently that particular person has put on a lot of weight since, so it's not him, right? But yeah, that was the talk of the Aussie InfoSec grapevine was... even though his face is blurred, he kind of looks like...
It does kind of look like who we think it is. But yeah, it's yeah. not. But it's not. Not him when,
it's not. It's someone completely different.
But, exactly. Unrelated.
But there you go. Unrelated. But yeah, we'll be tracking that one because I will be curious to see what sort of sentence this person gets because it's a non-violent offence and, you know, it wasn't like an offence for profit. Don't know what this guy's prior record looks like. But yeah, we'll have to see because the Australian courts don't generally... send people to prison as a first step. So we'll have to see what happens there. But Adam, that is actually it for this week's news. And in fact, there is no weekly show next week or the week after. So we will be chatting to you again in 3 weeks from today.
Yeah, thanks very much, Pat. I'll talk to you in a few weeks.
That was Adam Boileau there with a look at the week's security news. Big thanks to him for that. It is time for this week's sponsor interview now with Carsten Willems, the co-founder and chief executive of VMRay. VMRay makes a sandbox-based malware analyzer, and they also offer like file scoring, sort of more a detection thing at scale, based on the automated dynamic analysis they offer. It's all hinges on their sandbox. So yeah, if you're an incident responder or someone else, and you want to be able to throw suspect files at a verbose sandbox, then go have a look at VMRay. So yeah, back at DEF CON this year, VMRay helped out a bit with a machine learning malware classifier evasion competition that was mostly put together by Zoltan Balas of testing firm MRG Efetas and Hiram Anderson of Endgame Systems. And the idea was to pit contestants against some machine learning-based classifiers. They were given some malware samples that they'd have to modify. And at the end, you know, the malware would have to bypass these classifiers before wind up being executed in the VMRay sandbox to show that, yes, it's still malware and, yes, it's still functional bad software. And yeah, the point of the exercise was to demonstrate something that we mostly know already, which is machine learning is a useful tool, but there are pitfalls. Here's Carsten Willems.
the whole ML contest was mainly organized by Hiram from Endgame and Zoltan from MLG Efitas. And Zoltan came to me and said, well, Carsten, we want to build this great competition because everybody's claiming that ML solves everything and AI solves everything. And of course, we all know that is bullshit. Machine learning definitely is a very, very powerful mechanism for a few use cases. And I think malware classification and anomaly detection and that scenario makes sense to use ML, but of course it's not the silver bullet that will replace everything else. Yeah? Mm. And we have seen AV vendors in the past with very aggressive and very offensive marketing that wanted to push that AI solves everything. So this contest was pretty interesting. So I don't know how much you have heard about that and how it actually worked. So. If you had registered for that contest, and I think it's still running, yeah. Already it was already solved, so all the challenges had been solved already, and there was a prize that was given out. But the contest will still run until end of October. So if you're interested in breaking ML-based malware detection, take a look at the website, take a look at the link, and you still can participate. So how does it work? You can download 50 malware samples, and you can also download 3 different machine learning-based malware detection engines. And in the initial state, all the malware is detected by all of these engines. And now
it's just pure static file analysis, right?
I don't know. It's an ML-based model. It's 3 different models. They don't check any signatures, but they extract the features from the file. And in that sense, you're right. It's all static. It's all static features. So there's no sandboxing or anything like this involved in the first place. Yeah. So they extract features from the file content. And in the initial state, all the malware files are detected by all of these 3 models. And these 3 models, 2 of them are more or less academic models, and the other one is an open source machine learning based malware detection algorithm. So the participant, the attacker, can download the models, can download the algorithms, can download the malware samples, and now your challenge is to modify the malware samples that they still remain functional, but that they are no longer detected by the machine learning based algorithms. And as expected, we have seen that it's in most cases pretty simple to achieve that goal. In some cases, a bit more complicated, but we saw a lot of participants that were at least able to tweak the majority of the malware samples so that they get no longer detected by these engines.
Mm. We did see a paper a little while ago, it was this year, where someone just appended what I would call happy strings to the end of malware samples and managed to slide it by Cylance. I think they've tweaked things a bit to get that to solve that particular problem. But that's the thing, isn't it, right? Like, you never quite know why a machine learning classifier is making the decisions that it is making, right? So quite often bypassing these things is just a matter of doing something kind of unexpected and seeing what happens. Was that the approach that most of the contestants took with this?
Yes and no. So one of as you just said it, one of the downsides of all these ML-based classifiers is that there is no, or very often, especially in the scenario of neural networks, you don't know why the algorithm decides in a certain way. Yeah, you train it and you train it and you train it and it works in the end, but there is no knowledge. There is no insight that a human can defer from that.
Yeah, someone might ask, how does this work? And you're like, I don't know.
I don't know. But as you said, that blog post or that attack on Cylance, wasn't it just a string from a popular game that needs to be added?
Yeah,
to
I
the
think
malware?
So. And it's like games are funny, right? Like, game software, it's some of the, you know, that's the stuff that I think those machine learning classifiers have a big problem with, right? Because quite often there's anti-cheat in there, and there's like there's just a bunch of funny stuff in games that make them look a little bit like malware to machine learning classifiers. So I think really what you're doing is they might lower the thresholds a little bit for stuff that looks like gaming software, so you make it look like gaming software and then it goes, yeah, no worries, right? So I think that is, you know, that gaming software is like kind of like one of those edge cases that these machine learning based classifiers have trouble with, right?
Yeah, I agree with that. So what we have seen by the submissions of the participants on this contest, there were mainly three different approaches to evade the ML-based engines. So one approach was pretty simple, just adding some random bytes, some random stuff to the files so that their content changes. And this is called overlaying. So you search for some zero spaces in the file or some at the end of the file, and you just put some content there. And you tweak it, and you do it in a more or less brute force fashion until the ML engine does not detect it anymore. But the second approach is more interesting because
well, here hang on. I just want to pick that up there, right? Because that's interesting. Because theoretically, like that shouldn't work, right? Unless the content that you're sort of fuzz stuffing into these spaces for it kind of gets misclassified as a feature by the machine learning classifier, right? Like that's the only way that that's going to work.
Yeah, but that brings us back to the point we had earlier. So we don't really know how the ML algorithm internally weights. I mean, we know how it generates and extracts features. We know how it combines them. But in the end, there is some training derived weights that come out of the algorithm in the end, and you don't have any control how that works on data you have never seen before, right? You only know it's for the training set, and that's a problem. I mean, not all of these engines and not all of the files were able to be tweaked in that manner. But the second approach is very much related to that. So with the second approach, you do not just add random stuff, but you add benign stuff. Yeah. So what people did is they extracted code, they extracted whole file sections, whole code sections from existing Windows system libraries and added this benign code at the end of the file. Yeah. So there were much more benign features.
Yeah, so this is malicious features. Yeah, this is kind of what I was getting at with that last, that last thing where I sort of interjected is that, stuffing random stuff into a file, like how is that going to trick something that is supposedly extracting features, right? Whereas taking like known good strings and just sort of stuffing them into a file, I can definitely see how that might bear some fruit.
I don't know exactly how these ML algorithms work because I was doing fundraising for the last 10 months, so I was not that much involved in the technical details of that contest. But in my academic life, 6-7 years ago, I spent a lot of time in combining machine learning with dynamic malware behavior data. And what we saw all the time was it's not that much about the cleverness of the machine learning algorithm, but it's a lot, and it's mostly about the quality of the data that you use for training, that you use for feature extraction, and all that stuff. So therefore, if you have the wrong features, if you just take some random bytes, if they did histograms or n-grams or whatever, how they extracted features from the files. But if the feature quality, if the feature selection process is not well done, then you can put the smartest ML algorithm, the hardcore powered machines.
It's only as good as its training, right? Like, I get it.
Exactly. And that is what we see oftentimes when people, we use AI, we use ML. They don't know that much about ML, right? They just use some libraries and they may be using the right or the wrong algorithms, but as they do not really understand what is the essence of a totally unsupervised automatic classification process, it will never solve a problem. But you can put the AI and ML included sticker on your product, and that's
As long as it's on the website, that's fine. What was the third way that people were doing this?
That was using packers. Yeah. So one problem with traditional antivirus detection that is based on signatures is that once you change a few bytes or once you use a packer, the whole structure, the whole hash value, everything changes. And that is the reason why why every single antivirus product, traditional antivirus product in the world comes with some automatic unpackers. Yeah? So every time an AV engine tries to find out if a file is malicious or not, they try to unpack it so they can apply their signatures. And this is not done, at least not done by these ML algorithms that we used in the contest. So by packing the file, it was pretty easy to destroy all the features, to generate a lot of noise, and then it didn't work anymore. One problem with that is that, I mean, I didn't mention one point here in this contest, because it was not sufficient only that your malware gets no longer detected, but the other requirement that was that your malware was still completely functional, of course, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And a lot of these packers, if they were not applied properly, they destroyed some of the capabilities, some of the functionality of the malware.
Well, you know, we should point out too, VMRay's role in this whole thing is after these samples were slid by, they went into your sandbox to get blown up and make sure that they still did all of the bad things that they were supposed to do, right?
Yeah. So our role was let me go one step back. I mean, one of the drivers of inventing the whole sandboxing concept in one decade ago was that a sandbox is totally immune or agnostic to a packed malware, to an encrypted malware. We don't care. We as a sandbox runner, we don't care if something is obfuscated, encrypted.
No,
how many?
I mean, that's the whole point of dynamic analysis, right? Like, that's the point.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
You're looking at what it's doing, not what it looks like it's going to do.
Exactly. And therefore, VMRay was used as an evaluator or an assessor or an oracle. We just executed all the malware files we got. We generated a report, and by comparing the report of the unmodified malware to a report of the tweaked malware, it was super easy to automatically and in a scripted way find out if the malware is still functional. Yeah, and that was the role of VMRay. So
look, it sounds like in the case of this competition, you know, you had your three machine learning based classifiers. We should be careful too to point out that these were not necessarily fully developed production ready machine learning algorithms used by the likes of all these AV companies that are using that, and they are doing other stuff besides just doing static classification, right? This is a cut down exercise, right? Yeah. So just got to say that. But it sounds like, you know, it's a good starting point, right, for this sort of adversarial trickery. End result was you would have had a lot of people successfully sliding by.
Yeah. Yeah, and as we've seen from other real world practices, the actual way to kill or to evade a commercial product that uses ML or that relies on ML is not that much different. Yeah, it's probably more tricky and more work involved and so on the forest. But the general principle is the same, and we all know that these ML detection engines, while on the one hand generating more false positive, on the other hand they can be evaded like any other security.
And then it becomes the same game, right? Which is like what the signature based companies were doing, which is trying to get it instead of trying to create a signature, you're trying to get it into your training set quickly so that it's detected, right? And we're sort of back at square one. That's really interesting. I'm going to drop a link into this week's show notes so that people can go have a look at the competition. As you point out, it's still running, so if they want to go have a play with that, they can. But the other topic that I just wanted to very quickly touch on, you've just raised, as you mentioned, you've been doing fundraising the last 10 months. You've just raised a buttload of money, which is great, 10 million bucks. What are you going to do with it?
We have a pretty great technology, and as of today, we are at a point where we really need to scale up our sales organization, our whole operation organization, so more people can benefit from our great.
And is that going to be both on the sort of malware analysis side for people who are taking funny samples and throwing them in? You know, I mean, that's your primary sort of use case, but you do a bunch of deals with vendors too, as like for file scoring and stuff at scale. Are you going to be just pushing forward and trying to build both of those sides of the business?
So we started as a pure malware analyzer so that very skilled people can use our solutions to analyze unknown stuff, very, very sophisticated stuff where other solutions fail. And of course, the analysis of an unknown file is a necessary and required step to detect zero-day malware. Yeah, without a proper analysis, you are not able to detect something. I mean, yes, you can use machine learning with all the ups and downs that we addressed earlier.
But look, I get it. Your involvement in this thing, it's to prove a point, right? Which is at the end of the day, ultimately, some sort of dynamic analysis, there's always going to be a place for that.
Exactly. But having this said, as we can detect zero-day malware with this analyzer, and we can do that at scale and with a very, very high detection efficacy, more and more of our existing customers said, well, please give us a solution that we can not only use after something bad happened, but give us a solution that we can integrate into our email gateway, that we can integrate in our proxy, that we can integrate through an API in whatever way and in whatever product we like. And we just want to detect something. We don't care that much about why you think something is malicious, but we have seen that.
No,
you have
I get it, Carsten. Yeah? Like, you know, ultimately VMware is a sandbox company, and whatever applied use you can spin off, you're going to do it.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. And unfortunately, the big grow opportunity for us lies in the detection market and not in the analyze and analysis yeah. market. Because the analysis market.
Why do you think I asked, Carsten? Yeah. Because that's it, right? Like, I mean, you've just got a much bigger market there, right? Because detection is huge. And I have a feeling personally that the detection market is going to become more collaborative in the future. I had an interview with a blockchain startup, believe it or not, some time ago, and their whole idea was to build an incentive model so that people could submit samples and they would go and get scanned by different engines. And
you're talking about Polyswarm, right?
Yeah, Polyswarm, man. Like, that's interesting stuff. Yeah, yeah. So, you know, and I think that's where it's going to go, and that puts you in the box seat. We've already gone massively over time, Carsten, so I'm going to wrap it up there. But congratulations on your Series B. As I say, I'll drop some links into the show notes so people can check out that competition. And as always, a real pleasure to chat to you.
Thanks a lot for having me on the show. That was awesome, like every time. Thank you, Patrick.
That was Carsten Willems of VMRay there. And yeah, I always really enjoy talking to Carsten. You can probably tell. You can check them out at vmray.com. And I have seen VMRay in action, and it is a really effective tool for getting a quick idea on what a file actually does when it's executed. So you can get VMRay as a cloud service too. So if you are looking for a sandbox-based analyzer for those files that, you know, VirusTotal and other tools just don't have ready answers for, then do check them out at vmray.com. And that is it for this week's show. I do hope you've enjoyed it. I'll be back tomorrow with a Soapbox Edition featuring Yubico. There won't be any weekly news shows for a couple of weeks, as you heard earlier. But yeah, until next time, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.